Radio, and it's Inspiration with Manda and the amazing Mr. DJ Mark Gavell. Mark and I have done loads of miles together and some pretty big ocean races. He's one of my best friends, and I'm just so excited about introducing him to you all today. He's won Olympic medals. He's done Volvo Ocean Races. He's a commentator and a father to two of the most beautiful kids I know, and is also my favourite DJ, which is probably the main reason I got him on, actually. You can have your medals. I like his tunes. But Mark's done lots of inspirational talks for us when we were racing pretty competitively, and he's like Captain Good Vibes. So, hey, welcome to the show.
Amanda, lovely to be here.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And so, yeah, I kind of gave your autobiography, but do you want to just expand on that and introduce yourself to the crowds?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I was lucky enough to grow up in a sailing club. How about that? My father ran Hayling Island Sailing Club for the first 18 years of my life. And so, you know, I got an amazing place to grow up and a lot of inspirational characters around me. Including my father. And yeah, I mean, the other thing, my life has been shaped by the fact that I cannot spell and I'm not great at reading. And guess what? Another dyslexic sailor out there. I mean, most sailors, professional sailors, are pretty dyslexic. And, you know, that's why we do what we do. Otherwise, we'd be working in a bank, you know, or doing something like that. So
I totally agree. I say that to every one of my students when I'm doing the leadership or medical courses on boats, and you know, people are always surprised because they think it's just them. I'm like, you know, if we were corporate people and if we were good at writing and reading then and less adventurous, we'd probably be doing those sorts of jobs. And people think it's a bit of a joke, but it's quite real. Very much a reality, isn't it? But we're doers rather than.
Yeah, and it's certainly shaped my life. It's both. You know, I look back. It's both. It stopped me from doing a few things, or maybe it stopped doing a few things with more confidence. But you know, I wouldn't have gone down the amazing road that I did. So I absolutely celebrate being dyslexic and celebrate. You know, having the opportunities because of who I am and the skills that I have or don't have.
And let's talk about some of those opportunities. So what would be the most memorable things that you've been lucky enough to do in your life?
Well, I was lucky. My parents managed to get me to a school where they celebrated what you can do. You know, they basically said, you know, find something you're good at and be pretty good at it. You know, and that's an ethic that I've certainly used throughout my life. You know, celebrate your own skills and, you know, find something that fits that. And for me, it was I knew I liked making things with my hands. You know, along, you know, as a kid, I always just escape into the garage and find bits of wood and turn them into things, you know, and make stuff. So I knew that making stuff and doing stuff like boat building was going to be a perfect thing for me. So I headed down to Falmouth and did my time, went to yacht and boat building school and learned how to be a boat builder. And it wasn't long before I realized that being a wooden boat builder wasn't going to make you very much. And although I absolutely love my wooden boat building and I love working with, you know, also being around the sailing club, I knew that there were opportunities to go sailing. And, you know, while those opportunities were coming at me, I didn't want to turn them down. I remember going back to my boss at the boatyard and said, can I have some more unpaid leave, please? And he goes, Mark, you've got to decide whether you want to be a boat builder or a sailor. And I chose sailing, and that was the best day of my life, the day that I went, I'm sorry, mate, I'm off. And I realized that I could be both, actually. I you know, bought myself a little van and some tools. And, you know, the sailing and the boat building hand in hand. The more sailing I did, the more boat building and fixing. Admittedly, you know, it wasn't so much wood. It was fixing fiberglass, fixing aluminium masts, rigging, And slowly, the more work I did in that marine world, the more professional sailing gigs I got, the better boats I got on, the more I learned about sailing, the more there was to fix. And it wasn't long before I wasn't just fixing stuff, I was building boats. Someone said, right, you seem to know what the right end of a fast boat and a slow boat is. Because I was operating some a little bit of a speed shop back in those days where you sort of fare things and trick boats up. And I got my first opportunity to start building boats from scratch, which was fantastic. And then so now I'm a boat builder as well as a sailor.
Right on. And then how did the Olympics and fit into all of that? Because that's a pretty big commitment. You don't really have time to build boats. So where did that fit into the whole
Well,
thing?
the again, I think in life, if you're always looking for opportunities, you never just get up and go to work. You're always looking for opportunities to meet people, to go places, to better your world, to better your skills. And I think, obviously being in Hayling Island on the South Coast, I was surrounded by Olympians, great sailors, some of them were my friends. And again, my physicality, I'm 6 foot 7 and have been pretty much since I was 16. So, everybody loves a big guy on a boat if he gets in the right place and doesn't fall over his own feet. And that was, I realized that I had something to offer, being a big guy, being strong, with a certain amount of professional attitude, i.e. turn up, do a good job, don't be a dick. And I realized that was a pretty good formula. And so I got offered to start sailing Solings. And then I met my good friend Glyn Charles, who introduced me to Olympic sailing and Sailing Stars and Solings and Etchells and all those sort of good boats for a big guy back in the day. So yeah, that's how my opportunities came for the Olympics. Although I had been part of like the youth squad sailing, I quickly grew out of dinghies, and there isn't such a good youth scene in keelboats in those days. So I fell out of that a bit, but that had given me the background and the training in I knew where the Olympic bar was. I knew where what that level was and the level of training, the level of commitment. And as we all know, in the UK, around about that time, lottery funding came in. So when I had the opportunity to go full time, I'd already done an amateur campaign for the 92 Olympics, which we failed. We just didn't have enough funding, and we did a lot of things very wrong. But for the lineup run up to the 2000 Olympics in Sydney, lottery funding had just come in. So the fact that I was married, the fact that I wanted to start a family, it all meant that all that stuff would be paid for from the lottery funding, and it meant that we could go full-time sailing. So that was an absolute revolution in our sport, right across all sports in the UK. And I thank the system, to this day, through Sport England and the funding that allows sailors to go pretty full time.
Oh, that's amazing. Hey, is it true that so I heard that when you guys Olympic when you Olympic sailors are training and all together in a hotel, they get a bird of prey to sit on top of the hotel so the seagulls don't wake you up in the morning. Did you get the bird of prey keeping you asleep?
That was from
Allowing you to sleep?
that was so when they set up in Weymouth, which actually happened after my time. Weymouth has always been a great place to sail, and it was the home of Olympic trials for many years. Again, with lottery funding, they built their own accommodation, and the lead up to the 2012 London Olympics, which was obviously sailed in Weymouth, they realized that seagulls was a massive problem, and it was keeping the athletes up and not letting them sail. So I believe they did get some sort of bird of prey with a handler to come and manage the seagull population above the Olympic team. But this is, when you get into the Olympics, there are so many amazing people behind the scenes, most, right across from the technical side of things to the physical side of things, looking after brain, body, and soul, in order to allow you as the athlete to do your best. And if something is hindering there, if something is not right, then the Olympic manager and the team, try to put that right, so to allow you to do what you're there to do. So yeah,
So
so
cool.
that is a true rumor. Yeah, that did happen.
So you did the Sydney Olympics, didn't you, in
Did it back in
2000?
2000. Yeah, seems like a
Yep.
lifetime ago, an
It
absolute lifetime ago.
does. Yeah. Yeah, I remember being there. I think I spent most of the time in a nightclub and not at the events. But
And
and you came back
we'd
with
had
a
a,
few medals, didn't you?
yeah. Well, I mean, it's got to be said, we had a on a personal note, I had a. It was quite the journey. I first set out, as I said, I just mentioned my good friend Glyn Charles, who
Yeah.
was an absolute inspiration to me and taught me so much about Olympic sailing, and really brought me on as a sailor and an individual. And
Yeah.
And gave me so much, basically said, Mark, you can do this. This is, let's go. Here we go. And he had lots of incredible ideas about how to make a boat far, boat go fast, and also thinking out of the box. For example, he, one of the things he wanted to do was join two types of boats. At the time, there were three class boats, a Foley, a Lilia, and a Marder. And he liked the keel off one and the hull off the other. So he came up with some crazy idea to actually buy the two boats and cut them in half, and cut and shut the keel to the hull. Never
Wow.
been done before, never been done since. But it was a very successful boat. And unfortunately, the tragic part of this story is that he was one of the sailors that lost their lives in the Sydney Hobart in 98, the tragic race. And he never got to see that boat that he designed. But my good friend Ian Walker, who had unfortunately just lost his sailing partner in a car crash in Punta Ala, Johnny Merricks, he was a massive comfort for me at the time. Obviously, he'd been through what it was like to lose a teammate and a friend, and yeah, he was an amazing help and hand at the time. And also the family, Glyn's family, wanted me to carry on with Glyn's dream of winning a medal. So Ian and I amazingly decided it was a good idea to team up and see how far we could push this idea, this dream. And it was an amazing campaign. I mean, it really was. It was, I look back and it's such an inspiration now. We put a lot of hard work and time and money into it. Obviously, we only had 18 months to turn it round. And going into the Olympics, we weren't favourites at all. We were outside. No one had ever really felt that you come into a star last minute and come out with the goods. Everybody had to do their time in those days. You had to, put in, do several events, several Olympic years, and finally you might get there. But no, we proved the stats wrong. And yeah, we had a great week sailing. The boat was fast, thanks to Glyn, and we came away with a medal. Yeah, very, very, very
And do
proud.
you think that was a major motivation, doing it for Glenn and really
Yeah,
gave you the inspiration to just keep going and going and showing up and being able to compress that time into 18 months, which some people take a lifetime?
undoubtedly, there were times. Anyone who's done anything like a marathon or climbed a mountain that's been hard, and there's been a point where you hit a wall. You need these motivations to help you through. I find it quite difficult to actually motivate myself. I find it much easier to doing it for someone. I think about stuff I do for my family, or and having the motivation of Glyn behind me was amazing. And obviously channeling Johnny as well for Ian. But we're obviously doing it for ourselves and for each other. But also that campaign, I look back, and anyone who's seen the film The Blues Brothers, where those two Jake and Elwood are trying to raise the money for the orphanage. In a way, they were on some sort of mission from God, and anything that happened to them seemed to not affect them. That was like us. We hit so many walls, and for some reason, the answer just fell out. I know one day we were struggling to work out how to get the Star up to San Francisco, because we at last minute we decided to get up there to do some more heavy air training before we got to Sydney. And literally sat next to us listening to the conversation was another sailor in the bar, and said, "I'm heading up to San Francisco, and I can take your boat if you want." I mean, just stuff like that, just things, and it gets quite, you can think quite spiritually about it. But the world, it's one of these things. If you ask the world, the universe will deliver. And all I can say is those things happened. And we had a successful campaign, and we have the medal to look back on that. And also, people say to me, aren't you what, aren't you upset? You lost the gold by 1 point and just a few boat lengths. Not at all. Absolutely not at all. All the decisions we made along the way were the right decisions at the time. And we could go back and live that time 1,000 times again, and we would still make the same decisions, and our result would still be wonderful and still be the same. So, yeah, there's different ways you look at it, but it was a very happy time, and something I celebrate all the time.
And it's in the family because your amazing daughter Emily's also following in your footsteps and is doing a pretty good Olympic campaign, I believe.
It's been really interesting. Obviously, we're still very close to Hailing Island Sailing Club, so the opportunity to sail for both our children. My ex-wife Tracy's a very, very good sailor, and been behind the children sailing with me. And for Emily, we just showed her the water. She didn't necessarily jump to it competitively to start off with. She really just enjoyed mucking about on the water. I remember she'd come in from most of the events, and she would tell me about what they sung around the course, not what they did or what positions. So it's a good, any parents with children out there listening, just keep it fun in the boat. And then one day Emily said, "Actually, we want today, and I quite like that feeling of doing well. And Dad, could you tell me how to do that? How to." Like, I want to do some more winning, and I want to maybe team up with this girl and that girl and that guy, So she's been on her own mission to actually sail at the front end of the fleet. Interesting enough, she's 20, and she's just in her final year of university doing sports science in Bournemouth, and she's actually wisely decided to just put the sailing down for a while. The pressure from university and the sailing was, she realized that something, she was about to do both not very well. And very wisely, and on her own back, she's decided to concentrate on her uni now, and come back to sailing in the future. So yeah, I mean,
Good
I'm
on that.
very, very proud. I've not pushed her. And we'll see how she goes. She's also over 6 foot and quite athletic, and just loves the water. So I think that's
Absolutely.
well. So
And then you managed to fit a Volvo Ocean Race in as well, is that correct?
well, that comes from, and this goes back from, what I was saying before about just always looking for opportunities, and always, don't close your door to new voyages, new experiences. I had always, luckily being part of an Olympic crew, and then onto an America's Cup grinder in 2003 in Auckland. You kind of get to see how the media works around you all the time. You kind of get a pretty good insight of how documentaries and films and news and interviews and stuff work around you. And I quite like the idea of getting behind the camera. And I had an amazing opportunity to become the media man for the Volvo Ocean Race, Team Russia. And off we went. And that really was an incredible experience. I had not come from an offshore background. I'd crossed the Atlantic a couple of times, but I'd not really, done those. And I certainly had. I never thought I'd make it down to the Southern Ocean. And off I went, and it was my job to film and tell the stories. Naturally, unfortunately, we weren't one of the favorites to win or anything, and we certainly didn't. But documenting the stories and the highs and lows was amazing. And that led me on to do some more sailing on a 105-foot trimaran with the legend that is Paul Stanbridge, with Omar.
Stanbridge, we love you.
I've gone on and done more and more filming. I got the opportunity to work on the Audi Med Cup, the TP52s, the Extreme Series. So traveled the world with a camera, got into the fleets, and as a sailor used all my knowledge of filming and sailing to get the best shots, and often help the director to understand the sailing a bit more. But I mean,
Amazing.
also, and this I guess is where why I am sat here doing what I'm doing now,
Yep.
realizing that things are changing around you. Budgets change, events change, and as I was in that media world, realizing that budgets were being slashed, next season, can we put it on? Sponsors pull out, this sort of thing. Realizing that, so for example, we used to turn up at the airport with Sunset and Vine, with Andrew Priest as our leader, with something like 22, 25 people. And he would go and pay with the credit card, the company credit card, something like £3,000 in extra luggage, to get all the camera gear, the edit suite, all the tripods and everything, over to the event. Now that just wasn't sustainable.
Yeah.
So it's now filmed with a drone, some virtual eye, a presenter, and most of the stuff is now being managed and cut back in the UK or not nowhere near the venue itself, and you literally travel out to the venue with three or four people. Even some of the commentary is now, for example, the GP Sail GP, the commentary and most of that stuff is done in an office in Ealing, nowhere near the event. So
Wow.
I
Yeah.
realized that the likes of me were no longer going to get a job. I wasn't a producer. I wasn't. And a lot of operations like, big events like the Volvo Ocean Race, now the Ocean Race, they needed to reduce costs. They were inflating the cost of the race by as much as 15% each race. And it absolutely, it's just not sustainable to be spending that kind of money, flying all those staff around the world. And I realized that I needed to get out of that world because, my daily rates were reducing. So I realized that my DJing, something I had done for a long time on the side, I needed to take control of my own destiny,
Yep.
not sit there waiting for the phone call to ring, and actually, have my own little world of my own van, my own kit, my own ability to quote, my own ability to say yes or no to jobs. And that is what I'm doing now. I still am very connected to my sailing world. I hope to be DJing the Sail for Gold Ball, which is the wonderful celebrative goodbye and good luck to our Olympic team as they head off to Japan next year.
Oh, wow. Epic
I
gig.
yeah big gig I now commentate and DJ with the Sail GP event. I actually I'm laying down like a soundtrack to the racing.
I
The
didn't
race,
know that. Get out.
brilliant fun. The racing starts and I start playing music, and I they get around the top mark and head down at, touching 50 knots, and I am matching the music. And right now I can tell you the only music I've really found to like just totally underscore the amount of adrenaline and the excitement of the SailGP circuit is drum and bass. We are dropping
Yeah.
drum and bass to the crowds in, from the bleachers, from the grandstand. At the same
On that
time,
note, for anyone listening that are into their music and their D&B or drum and bass, I don't know what you call it, but what would be one of your favorite drum and bass artists that match a good 50 knot downwinder?
I'm really into Andy C at the moment. If you want to check out some really good drum and bass, Andy C's your man at the moment. But there's
Perfect.
such good remixes. The Fatboy Slim drum and bass remix by High Contrast. That's one I get going, right here, right now. And you absolutely start pumping the music out. The SailGP have invested in really good sound systems right across the village. And I look round, and where before you'd see people sat on the on you know cow's bank, on the beach, watching some extreme sailing, sat eating sandwiches, people are now stood up, pumping out like they're at a gig, hands above their head, giving it this, and they don't realize that
Oh, really?
they're at like a gig, but the whole emotion, the sound, the commentary, and obviously the incredible racing, it right in front of you. And we've run that out at, all the events, San Francisco, New York, Cowes, Marseille. It's been an amazing season, and look
That
forward to
is
more of it.
epic.
But the whole
And
concept
you're
is
also the
bringing
Cowles
all those
Big
skills.
DJ.
Yeah,
Sorry.
just bringing all the skills. Like, when I
Yeah.
first pitched it, I think the management turned around and said, "Where are you going to find a sailing DJ?" And I said, "Well, hello."
Guess what?
But no, I'm really lucky. I thank, thank the days every day, and I work with a great production team to bring the live event. So, but
Yeah, but is it luck, or is it, as you say, having foresight and being adaptable to change? And also, as you know, I'm so into inspirational characters like yourself. Because I love the way some people just say, I want to do that, and I'm going to go and do that. And sometimes, especially in yachting, we have this joke when people go back to, say, Australia, where I'm from, and we always laugh and say, bye, they'll be back. They'll be back, because it's a very hard world to leave, emotionally, physically, mentally, and financially. But it's also sometimes, many of us, for example, like my sister and I, you get into sailing and your qualifications may run out. So what you trained in at university is no longer relevant anymore. Then you've been at sea for 10, 5 or 10 or 20 years. And sometimes we can get a bit lost. And then you think you just have to stay with your yachting job, or that you have to go and restudy. And the world we live in these days, you don't need a qualification to
no.
be an inspirational radio host. You don't need a qualification to be a DJ. You can actually really create whatever it is you want when you want, and have and be and do and have it all, which is the reason I've got you on, because you're a really good example of that.
Well, it's an interesting concept because I, for example, we both have just from being in the sailing world, we both know a lot of very, very professional and talented photographers. The guys that have come from, the old days of film, and developing, having to develop your images, your and when digital photography came in, all of a sudden these pretenders who just go out and buy a digital camera, they've got pre-selected filters. Back in the day, they would have to work really hard on just one image to make it, stand out, or to crop it, or to make it look differently. Now everyone can be a digital DJ, or everyone can be a digital photographer. Everyone could be a filmmaker. Everyone's learning how to, film on their own phones. They have a whole production suite in your pocket. Now, that's been a good thing and a bad thing. Obviously, for those professionals, who have been doing it along in the teeth and have found that their world has changed incredibly quickly, are having to rebrand and understand and stay ahead of the likes of bedroom DJs like me. But it also has opened up the world, and we've challenged them to be different and do things differently, which is, I think, is a good thing. But equally, the hardware and the prices of digital cameras, the digital controllers, have come down, and it's made it available for the likes of me to get into and then learn. I mean, for example, I've just bought this bit of kit. I've got my decks just down here, and this is another piece of kit from Pioneer, to allow me to do even more things with my music, digitally change it and manipulate it. And I've just started getting to use it, and it just means that I can start to do more and more funky things on the hoof when I'm DJing. And the guy, someone like Fatboy Slim or Deadmau5, or they probably got the same bit of kit, and they're trying to work out how to move their creativity on with it as well. So the world is so much more malleable, and everyone can get hold of this kit now and be creative, and it's how you use it. So I do use my contacts from my sailing, unashamedly. And I do use the skills I've learned, the people skills, the things that I've picked up along the way. I've always tried to be a good guy. I've always tried to turn up and do a good job and say please and thank you. And those are the skills that have helped me network and getting me the work I'm getting now and pay my
But
mortgage.
what about your mindset? I mean, we've been sailing together on some pretty massive races, nothing like the America's Cup or the Volvo, but in my world, in my lunchbox, we've done some pretty epic stuff together. And you've got an incredible mindset. We've always called upon you to, we've sailed together with people like Robin Knox Johnson and, Gina Houston, Fraser Brown, Andy Green, Jason Beaver, some really epic sailors, and loads more, loads more.
Brian Matthews joined us
And
on
you've
that, lovely
always
hat.
done our pep talks, and you've always got us ready. And that was before we had DJs on the decks in the Sydney Hobart, and so we didn't have a theme song to go out of the heads, which I think we should totally do next time. But you've always had this ability to really get people bonded and together, and you are one of those guys that's the crew glue as well. You know what? You have this knack of getting to know everyone in the crew intimately and really helping everyone gel. How do you do that?
Well, that's a big question. And maybe you don't actually recognize that in yourself, but I think one of the things is I don't take it's very easy to take life a little bit too seriously. And I think, I guess from school, maybe I was the class clown a little bit because I struggled at school. So I've always tried to sort of see a funny side to life and a lighter side to life. I don't, I mean, we're all on the spectrum. I don't know where on the spectrum I sit, but we're definitely on the spectrum somewhere. And I've just been, I guess, I do think I do see life slightly differently to some other people. When I've been in relationships, I've my observations, and you get to know someone else, they start to say, you realize that you don't think like anyone else. You have slightly, your my humor, all of these sort of things. I quirky, I think they call it. So I think in times like bringing a crew together, it's about not going with the obvious, the sort of stiff messages, but actually just feeling what the vibe is on, from the people, feeling what the event is going to be like, and just getting people to use their own motivations and their own expectations, and just letting and just giving people permission to get out and enjoy the race. And so I mean, it's very difficult to talk specifically about one thing or another,
Yeah.
I think.
So how about what would you say would be the fundamentals in building a strong crew? In super yachting at the moment, we've got quite a few issues with in mental health, because everything's got bigger, the boat size, the stress, the loads, the crew numbers, the time at sea, how remote we go. I think it all contributes. And maybe also the industry's got bigger and it's not just made of people that grew up on boats like you and me. So, it can be a little bit of maybe being uncomfortable in your surroundings. But so how in your experience with the America's Cup, the Volvo, the Olympics, what built, in terms of leadership and building strong teams, is there anything that, one thing I'm really a big believer in, and I love working with you and in our race crew, is we're really big on briefs and debriefs. And you've always been a big part of that. Is there anything you could expand on to build good crew ethics and communication skills in large teams?
I have absolutely the answer for you. It's something that I've been lucky enough to be part of some incredibly successful and wonderful teams, but I've also been lucky enough, and I would say lucky enough because it's important to be part of teams that aren't so great and have got it wrong and made some pretty big made some big errors along the way and just haven't set it up correctly. But the thing that I think that is the go-to ethic to get behind is trust, trust, and trust. Trust to have a team that can get it wrong and stand up in front of their peers and admit that we're not getting it right, that they screwed up or whatever. The old days of this belligerent team tough, I don't think has a place anymore. I was part of several teams that you had to work hard to just keep sticking your chest out and be stronger and stronger. There was no place for anyone sort of saying I'm not coping or maybe we're not doing this right. No one dared. And I think if you look at modern teams now, there's so much more the ability for to actually be more honest and actually be a little bit more vulnerable. And I know that sounds in the old tradition of being soft, but it's actually creating an environment where learning and the ability to change and go forward is a lot more it's set up in that respect. But you know what I mean?
Oh, I totally do. There's a new science, as you know. I'm really into my leadership after years of working in emergency and on boats, and then in the marine medicine field, and now coaching. Like you, I continue to move forward in business, and there's a in leadership. There's a new trend, and it's called conscious leadership, and it's about vulnerability being seen as a strength. And that it's okay to say it's not okay, and really using those abilities and that honesty to create more trust, to create a better foundation and stronger roots. Because I know, once again, sailing in good and bad teams, it was pretty hard 20 years ago to say I can't, which is often ends in injuries. If you say I can't do this, you would try and try and try. It was hard to say I'm having a hard time because my grandma died last week. So we were keeping all these cards so close to our chest. But when we're building a really strong team, I believe we need to be very open with each other. And I think that's why we had such a strong team when you and I were working together. Because we took it away from, the boat and developed really strong friendships and supported each other through, and I know that that wasn't such a big thing 20 years ago in competitive sailing or in any in medicine or corporate or any industry, I guess.
No, I think you're absolutely right. The vulnerability of and just and that comes with confidence and the fact that you feel that you can say something without your teammates overly judging you. Like you said, if you felt like if you put your hand up and said, "I can't do this" or "I'm struggling," then you just get thrown off the boat and you wouldn't get a second chance. You know, nowadays, you know, the environment is much more. Well, what are you struggling with? Can we train you up? Can we give you more knowledge? Can we give you more practice? Do you need more time on the boat? You know, rather than to actually bring you on the skills. I mean, I famously, for some reason, the people I'd sailed with as a crew always did downwind tactics. You know, and I was too busy at spinnakers, and I kind of was pretty weak in downwind tactics. And then when I started sailing with Ian Walker, sat on the foredeck looking back. As you do as on a star, and you know he starts asking me all these tactical questions, and I'm going, well, I think we should be doing this, but I don't know because I'm not very good. And he goes, right, here on in, like day one, right, I need to be going fast. I need to be sailing this boat, concentrating, looking forward. I cannot be looking over my shoulder all the time. And Mark, you're looking back. You're the ideal person to do the downward tactics. And I said, yeah, but it's my weak spot, and I'm not very good at it, you know. And he said, right, by the end of our time together, you're going to be the best downwind tactician out. And so it's that, A, that trust and that vulnerability to for me to turn around to him and say, I'm not very good at it, rather than trying to just bullshit him.
Yeah.
And him to actually say, no, I'm not going to beat you up for this. I'm actually going to help you get better. And together as a team, you get better. But that needed trust, vulnerability, and just humiliation, you know, humility between the two of us. And that I only ever saw on small teams, and it never came up to bigger teams. But I'm definitely, some of the teams I'm working with now are much more, you know, I think, yeah, they're more, you know, they have ability to be a bit more vulnerable.
That's amazing. And another issue... that's coming up a lot in yachting is gender equality. There's been, you know, so I was quite fascinated recently to learn there was a study going on for women in sailing, and I was fascinated to hear that that gender actually comes under sustainability as a topic, which I thought actually makes a lot of sense, but you'd never think that. And my sister and I talk about this a lot at length because we find we were probably sailing with people like you. We don't feel that we personally ever had an issue with gender equality. We feel like we were probably pushed and encouraged to sail hard and be able to do everything. But I know it's becoming a big topic and some people feel there's a lot of discrimination. Being a father of a grown woman now and having had a daughter in sailing and sailing with many wonderful women. What's your stance on gender equality in yachting now?
Well, I've been really lucky. So, for example, sailing with you two sisters, you know, we were on a big heavy boat, a Swan, and you know, there was a certain amount of physicality on that boat, and you know, Gina, your sister, is an incredible individual. She's this huge life force. But she's tiny. She's absolutely tiny. And you, in my mind, when you sail with her, and she's the, you know, the boat captain of this great big thing, and her brain is all over, you know, from electrics to the navigation to all the sails, all the kit. You know, she's there to keep the whole thing together. So in your head, you don't even think of it, you know, as she's a female. You just think she's the skipper and she knows stuff and she's running it.
Yeah.
And the first time you kind of have to sort of double take is when you're up on the foredeck trying to shift a sail, this, you know, huge bricked head sail. And Gina kind of says to you, on you go, Mark. I can't even get the sail tie over, you know. And then you suddenly think, oh yeah, she's not as big as I am. I can lift this sail, or at least I can move it. And she can't. And what I'm saying is I've been very lucky to sort of be around women who and I'm going to be careful here. Don't play the female card. She's actually just sailing, and we're all part of the crew. And just like a smaller guy would have said to me, "Come on, you big oaf, you move that sail, you know." But going back to your original question about the opportunities and my view of my daughter going into sailing, it still is about opportunities. It's still about time on the water. You know, I was able to sail on better and better boats, and get better and better gigs because of my experience. And the more sailing I got, the better I got. You know, it's just time on the water. We all know that. And I think, and I don't, I didn't realize how little opportunity that, there is, or there certainly was, for female sailors. So the Magenta Project, and events like that, organizations like that, who are getting women just more experience. The changes that we've made in the Olympic classes, I think boats like the NACRA, having just getting women sailing as much as anyone else. And there's no reason why. Why was there ever a reason why? It was just because it's a male dominated thing. And when you're picking teams, you go, "I'll have him, and him, and she can do the cooking." It's all wrong. It's all wrong. And I don't, I think I think it has changed. I think it's got a hell of a lot, long way to go. I was quite disappointed looking at the lineup for the latest Clipper, that I know your brother has had some great success in. It was an all male skipper lineup. And reading some of the comments, there just weren't the women that were stepping up for those roles. So I think it will change. I think the filter's coming through. There are so many more women sailing at a higher and higher level. So I think it's not about ability. Yes, of course there is some physicality, just like the same as you get big guys and small guys. But I think it's just a matter of time. It's it's ha events being open to a more level playing field, and the women taking the role in just getting more experience. Now I'd have to hear from more women in the business to understand whether they're hitting a wall, whether they are coming up against a glass ceiling, and whether the business, the industry is changing enough for them to feel that they've got some clear, roots, as the same as men. So that would be an interesting topic for another guest to actually find out from someone like Annie Lush, or someone who has got a pretty good insight of where, maybe where that glass ceiling is.
Yeah, Annie is definitely on my hit list. So are many of those girls. That leads me to my next question too, because another thing I think that happens to us, not just in yachting, but is that, we give it our all. And sometimes with jobs, we life short, and we give so much, and sometimes we put our own health at risk. And sometimes I'm really, one thing that's had a massive effect on me that I'm really preaching at the moment, especially because I've recently had an accident that's made me relook at my life a bit and how much I was doing rather than being. And this is something you and I've spoken about, and I know you've grabbed me and really shaken me before a Sydney Hobart before and said, "Amanda, calm down, have a breath. It's only a boat race. You're awesome, and who cares about the chocolate fudge? Let's go, just go and have a good time." Have you got any thoughts on that? Because it's the industry is getting stressful, and I had four suicide calls, near suicide calls I had to attend last week, of friends of friends, people know that I'm a nurse in the industry and really, you know, into my transformational coaching. And four mothers reached out to me saying, I'm really worried about my child. Would you mind popping in and seeing if they're okay? Or would you mind just giving someone a call? And you know, I know you've learned the hard way too. What advice have you got to tell people that sometimes smell the roses? You know, life's important. Sometimes we do too much, and it can be to our own detriment and have a devastating effect on our health.
Yeah, I mean, I keep going back to the environment I grew up in. The environment you get into something like the Olympic team, and naturally you're going to be around some incredibly motivated people. I mean, you know, I was in an America's Cup team. There were, you know, 100 people. All at the best they can possibly be. You know, the best rigger, the best laminators, the best fitness guys, the best dietitians, the best marketing team. You know, everyone is top of the game. You know, that's why they're that industry, and they all know how to self motivate. And guess what? They all know how to push themselves. My gym partner and great grinding buddy on in the America's Cup I did, was Greg Searle. And, you know, he's got a few, you know, gold and Olympic medals to his name. And he's an incredible athlete and motivator. But what I'm trying to say is it's very easy not to see where the fuse is. You just keep pushing yourself because you're surrounded by people that are constantly raising the bar. And whether that you're just in normal business, you're just trying to work hard, you know, bring the pennies home, or you're part of a you know, professional sailing team, you've got to just understand where your own fuse is, where your own cutoff point is. And you know, here's the showstopper. About 6 years ago, I actually went past my fuse and woke up one morning having a heart attack, and had a second heart attack in the ambulance on the way to hospital. And obviously that changes your life. And the major change, apart from being lucky enough to survive a heart attack, the major change is actually understanding where your own fuse is, where the edge is. And I completely now, my life, you know, again, one of the reasons I changed, trying to scrap in the industry that I was in, was realizing that I was gonna have to push past my fuse, my breaking point, in order to keep on doing what I was doing. So you've got to understand your own body, your own stress levels. You've got to understand where your walk away point is. You know, I used to drive like a maniac, as in always trying to pass the next car, always trying to push the lights, always trying to, you know, I drove like I was on the race course. Yeah. And I pissed off if someone cut in front of me. You know, I could feel my heart rate go up and down. You know, I'm not a bad person. I'm not a bad driver, but it was just part of my nature that I just wanted to get, when I got behind a wheel, I wanted to get there real quick. And now, although sometimes I'm rushing for a plane or whatever, I totally check myself. This is not worth pushing my blood pressure up. If I miss the plane, there'll be another plane. Lucky enough, I can throw money at a few things, as in it's only money. You know, it's only a race. It's only a... You know, so you've got to be careful, because obviously you can't just keep on throwing money at things just because you're trying to get an easy life. But what you're doing is you're building in a fuse in your life that you just got to do things a little slower, a little bit more gentle, just please and thank yous, just being a nicer person. You just bring the stress levels down, and understanding when you're going to get close to that. You know, I totally now have like this little, I used to go green and then red. I now have developed an amber in my life. that I
Beautiful.
realize when I am getting to that point and I need to change something. I need to ring a client up and say, look, I'm really sorry. This thing we're trying to do isn't going to happen. Or we're going to have to do it differently. Or can I suggest that we do it, tomorrow, not today?
Yeah.
And just understanding that sometimes these missions are not worth breaking your balls for, because I learned the hard way, because I was pushing myself too hard. I learned the hard way, and obviously to look after yourself.
Yeah, so important.
But I think just understanding. So, I mean, my advice there in a sentence is learn where your fuse is, and
Yeah.
adjust your a fuse right down now. Like, find an amber in your life.
Find an amber and do what you love. You could end up being a DJ. We're going to start wrapping it up in a minute because
Cool.
it's been an epic show and we've got someone coming on next. But I'd just like to finish off with one of my favorite questions. If you were stuck on a desert island with one person, who would it be and why?
Oh gosh, you sprung that on me. Oh my God. I'm gonna have to say to you, and I'm gonna try not to get too emotional here. I think it would be my good friend Glyn Charles, because when he died, I just never felt that I knew him well enough and had gotten enough capers with him. And he was someone who would be brilliant to spend time on a desert island, because he would be constantly trying to build things, constantly trying to get off the desert
Except you'd
island,
be off in a minute on
not
a fastest
constantly
speed trunk.
trying to make the desert island even better. And he'd be an absolute pleasure to be with. And it's someone who left us too early, and I'd love to spend time with him. So there
So
you go. There's
beautiful.
my
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for being on the show. We might get you on again sometime. And if
Fun.
so you just let's do a little bit of promotional stuff. If anyone wants an epic DJ that can race really well and drive a camera, you're open to
On Facebook,
travel.
connect
And
with me on
we can
Facebook.
find you on Facebook. We'll put your link down below. And also, you are quite an active DJ here where I'm at the moment in Hampshire and around the UK as well. That's sort of your thing now, isn't it?
DJ Cavell,
DJ
just
Cavell.
Facebook or Instagram, DJ Cavell. So
Check
yeah,
him
track.
out, guys. You can have DJ Cavell cranking out as you're doing your wash down later today after all this rain. And Mark Cavell, thanks so much. DJ Cavell, thanks so much for being on the show. I love you so much, mate. You're just awesome.
Thank you, Amanda, and keep the good work up. Real inspiration. Thank
Yay.
you. All right.
All right. Speak soon. Thanks, everyone. You're on Yachting International Radio with Nanda J.